Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
I was a soldier, then a veteran, a husband, and a father. And with my VA home loan, I'm a homeowner. No down payment required and no PMI. Build your future with the VA home loan. Get what you earned. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for this hyper amount of benefits mentioned here.
Welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. I'm your host, Richie Billing, and today I'm delighted to be joined by best-selling fantasy author, Jim Hines. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Richie.
Oh, I'm thrilled you could join me, Jim. It's fantastic writing career that you've had, working with big publishers like Door Books, receiving awards, nominations, and make it onto the bestseller list. So it really is an honor to speak with you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a good 20 plus years. I've been very fortunate in a lot of ways.
Oh, well, it's if the stories aren't good, then you don't last long, do you? So it's a testament to how good a writer you are, and I'm looking forward to diving into it today. We've got a couple of new, well, one new book coming out soon, haven't you? And re-releasing some classics too.
Yep, it's a busy month. I've got Kite Master is the new one coming out at the end of the month. And then tomorrow, actually, the three Goblin books, three of my first fantasy novels, are being re-released as ebooks.
Nice. Congratulations on both. Very exciting.
Yeah. Big month.
Pulled left, right, and center with the PR.
It's been a little hectic, yeah. And I've got to be honest, the PR is not my favorite part of the job. I enjoy talking to people. I enjoy like chatting with you, but there's a part of me that's more introverted and I'd just rather be writing. Let somebody else handle the advertisement.
Yeah, I get that completely. I like podcasts because it's quite informal, isn't it? Like we're just like having a pretty laid back conversation now, and it doesn't feel too strenuous. But I imagine having to do like events like quite a lot. Do you do a lot of conventions and things like that?
I don't actually do that many anymore. Earlier on, I would push myself to do more of them each year, partly because that was the advice, is go out, do conventions, meet editors, meet agents. It's all about word of mouth and who you know. And it never really worked out that way for me. I mean, I did meet some people. I made some connections. I can point to a few short stories I sold through making those connections. But the amount of time, the amount of energy that goes into it, I think really the primary goal has to be just keep writing, keep improving, keep sending stuff out. You know, these days, if I do the conventions, it's more to see the people. It's not a career thing as much as, hey, I want to go hang out with my writer friends and see what they've been up to and laugh and catch up.
Yeah. No, I understand. I don't do many conventions myself, but the reason why I do go is for that exact same reason you've just said. And I do find them a little bit intimidating sometimes because there are a lot of egos there.
There are a lot of
people looking to make a point, and if you're not really in that frame of mind, I don't know about you, it threw me off a bit. And it kind of makes me less inclined to go to more.
But the very first convention I went to, I had gotten onto one panel. And I was all excited. I was, you know, I had published like two whole short stories at that point. And I get onto the panel and I was so overwhelmed. I didn't say a word for the entire hour.
Yeah.
You know, a few times some of the other panelists would look at me and sort of have that confused expression, like, is this thing on? Is he broken? But it was just too much at that point. I got overwhelmed and I sort of shut down.
Yeah. I get what I mean. You are sort of, like you said, you pushed to do it, aren't you? And sometimes you do things before you're ready. But the main thing is that you did it. And I suppose going back and doing the next convention, even though you didn't say anything in that first one, at least you sat up there in front of everybody and put yourself out there.
And so. I didn't die.
Exactly. Yeah. So sometimes you need little things like that.
And it definitely got better over time. It got a little easier. I was able to relax more. I learned some of the tricks, like when I go to a convention, I am going to need times that I just go back to my hotel room and hide and decompress and recover for an hour. Then I can go out and interact with people again.
Yeah.
And also getting to know people, you know, whether it's meeting people and building those relationships at the conventions or going with someone, going with a friend, I think can make a huge difference. I wish I had known, you know, back in the late 90s, take a friend with you, have fun together. It would help a lot with that sense of isolation and feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah, certainly agree with that one. So where did it all begin for you? Did you always want to be a writer growing up, or is it something that you came into later in life?
I did not, actually. When I started undergraduate after high school, my plan was to become a psychologist. I was going to be a therapist and save the world that way. And a friend of mine, he's a year or two younger, and he wanted to be a writer. And he had written some short stories and he showed them to me from time to time. And I remember thinking, this is cool. This is interesting. And I'd always been a big science fiction fantasy reader. So I'm watching my friend do this and I figured, oh, well, how hard can it be? I'll give it a try. And as I imagine a lot of people listening know, it's harder than it looks. But in that initial sort of, hey, give it a try, see what happens, I found things that I loved. You know, I loved the creation. I loved those moments when a story comes together. And I was just having so much fun with it that I kept going. Then, you know, I sent some stories out, and as almost all of us do, I got rejected. And I think that hit some sort of button in my brain that stubbornness gene.
Yeah.
Saying, oh, you rejected this, did you? Well, I'll show you. I'll write one that's even better and you'll buy that one.
Nice.
And it wasn't quite that quick, but I am happy to say that after, I would say, 4 years of writing and submitting, the person who rejected that very first short story did end up buying a different story of mine.
Nice.
But yeah, a lot of it comes down to my friend Tim, and he was writing. And if he hadn't been doing that, I honestly don't know if I would have gotten the idea to sit down and try it myself.
Yeah, it's amazing. And then you just tried it and fell in love.
Yeah. I had written one or two things over time growing up just for fun, but never seriously, never with the idea of being published or being a quote unquote author or any of that. I think honestly, for a lot of us when we're young, you know, it doesn't even occur to you that much that there are actual people behind all of these books, that being an author is something you can do.
Yeah, you know, it's never really encouraged in school, is it?
Well, and I can kind of understand it. It's not exactly the most lucrative or stable career in the world. But I love it.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing of passion, isn't it?
It has to be, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I don't know. You see sometimes people go, oh, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make all this money and I want to get all these awards and stuff. It's not about that, really. I don't think you could sit here like at a desk for God knows how many hours and just read the same thing over and over again.
Yep.
If you didn't love it. So.
And then if you're really fortunate and you've done this for years and you get that novel manuscript off and somebody actually wants to buy it, and most of the time they come back with, okay, and for this project that you've poured however many years of your life into, we're going to give you $5,000.
Yeah.
You really can't do it for the money.
No. We'll talk a bit about that later, because you've very open and transparent about earnings in the writing world, and it's something I really appreciate, and I think a lot of people should hear it as well. So it would be great to dive into that a bit more. I was going to ask you about the Goblin Quest books, and was that one of your earlier pieces of longer fiction, or how did all that come about?
Goblin Quest was the first novel-length fantasy story that I actually sold. I had written a few other book-length manuscripts. They sent them out. The publishers sent them right back. And Goblin Quest, it was a bit of a revelation, because those earlier books, I had been trying really hard to write capital G good books. I was, you know, what's going to sell? What's going to be well received? What are, you know, how do I become a great author? And at the time that I started writing Goblin Quest, I had just quit a job in Nevada. I had been coming off of a bit of a bout of depression. And I was in a space where, you know what? I don't care. I'm just going to write something fun and goofy. And it's going to be this sort of Dungeons and Dragons style adventure from the point of view of the goblin. And it's going to be ridiculous. And he's going to have a pet spider who sets things on fire. And I just had fun with it. And I laughed. And it was, I mean, I kind of love that little goblin and the fire spider. And then it turned out that that was the book that sold. The one where I stopped worrying about what should I be writing, and just wrote what I wanted to and just had fun with it.
Yeah.
I wish I had learned that lesson earlier. But yeah, that one sold originally to a small press called Five Star, then got picked up by Daw Books along with two sequels. And, you know, they kept it in print for close to 20 years. And now finally it's being re-released. It's revised a little bit. I threw in some bonus material, and it's Jig the Goblin kind of started my career.
Yeah. Nice. It's great to bring him back then, isn't it? Take full ownership of him again.
It's been fun, you know, and it's interesting to look back. And as I was revising them, you know, in some ways, there were a lot of little sentence level things where, oh, this could have been smoother and I'm going to reword this. And because you grow over 20 years, or hopefully you do. Yeah. But also some of it, even 20 years later, the fun is still there. You know, I still, reading the story again, I still felt that love for these characters and sympathy for poor Jig getting dragged along on this adventure when all he wants to do is be left alone.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been fun going back to that.
Yeah. Sort of. What was it like writing that story? Obviously,
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Mixing things up and picking a goblin as the main character. I mean, did you, it was like, I mean, you mentioned it was, you're paying homage a bit to Dungeons and Dragons. So did you tend to stick to the sort of classic tropes to do with goblins, or did you just mix things up and go your own way?
Bit of both, I would say. My goblins are, well, I wanted to write from the underdog's perspective. Yeah. And goblins are fairly low on that hierarchy.
Yeah.
You know, they're small, kind of scrawny. Most of them, in my world at least, are not terribly bright. And it was fun, you know, and they're unashamed of who they are. You know, they are goblins, they are the underdogs, and they embrace that. You know, they know what their role is in the whole fantasy world, adventure, hierarchy. They're going to go out, they're going to probably get slaughtered, but some of them will survive, and that'll be great. And maybe they will kill some of the elves and bring one back to eat for supper.
Yeah.
Because they're also, you know, when adventurers come in, you kill them and you eat them. There's not a lot of food variety in your caves and caverns. And just, it was fun getting into it and deciding, okay, you know, for when they do capture the elf, they're going to have a chef who's very, very good. You know, it's not just going to be your typical fantasy, we sit down and eat stew. It's like, yeah. No, we're going to have barbecued elf ribs sprinkled with fire spider eggs and sort of sauteed in oil of whatever fungus we have growing on the cave walls this week.
nice premium.
So, yeah, I mean, it started out with some of those Dungeons and Dragons tropes, but I like to think that it got developed and grew a lot beyond that, especially over the course of the second and third books.
Yeah. So what was it like creating Jig as a character? Do you have a sort of process when you're creating characters generally too? Is it to create such a successful series? I mean, for me, the characters make it. It's the only reason you'd carry on, really. So like, it's great to see that like you've created Jig, who's like not your typical hero. And then people just loved him. So what was it like, that process of bringing him to life?
It was interesting. Jig and Smudge, more than a lot of the characters that I've written, they were pretty well developed from the start. I think partly I did project a fair amount of myself into Jig. You know, he's this brawny little runt, even among the goblins. He gets picked on by everybody. He's nearsighted. Some of what Jig is going through was my life during junior high. You know, I was the scrawny little nearsighted nerd getting picked on by all of the bigger kids.
Yeah.
So, you know, I could definitely relate to Jig.
Yeah, I've got a sense of that before as well, when you were describing how like you don't really like the conventions, and then you said Jig just wants to be left alone.
I like the conventions, but yeah, it's overwhelming.
You mean,
and yeah, Jig So I wanted somebody who was not your muscle bound Conan the Barbarian type, but I also wanted him to be clever. I wanted him to survive by outthinking the other goblins and the other adventurers and just coming up with these creative ideas that, you know, they're not the sort of ideas that the heroes would have. They're not heroic or honorable. They're goblin ideas. And so creating that, letting him become more clever and pushing him into these situations where he had to, you know, fight and think and get out there in the adventures that he absolutely hated. It was a blast.
Yeah.
No. I've said before, you know, more than any of the other characters I've created, if Jig were ever to meet me in person, he would immediately stab me in the face. Just for all of the stuff that I've put him through.
That's what you gotta do to your characters, though. Put them through hell.
In general, yeah. Yeah. If you're just being nice to them, it doesn't usually make as much or as good of a story.
Yeah, I agree. What other sort of key storytelling techniques do you like to follow, or would you recommend writers check out?
Key storytelling techniques. One of the things that I need to do, and obviously everybody's process is different, but for me, I find myself needing to do like a one or two sentence summary of who the character is and what it is that they want. You know, what is that one core desire that's sort of driving everything?
Yeah.
For Jig, it would be he wants to survive and be left alone. Almost everything he does is, how do I get out of this? How do I survive? Some of the other characters, it gets a little more complex. Like in Kite Master, the protagonist wants to stop the evil queen and protect her friends and family. But having that one sentence, it lets me go back whenever I get stuck and say, okay, what does this character want? That's going to dictate what they do next. You know, when the plot gets stuck, when I'm not sure what to do next, let the character drive that. What do they want? What is their next step to get that?
How can you stop them from doing it?
Well, yeah, and then we throw obstacles in their way, and or we give them unexpected consequences.
Nice.
Or, okay, you've made this small step, but now the stakes are higher because the bad guys are reacting to what you've done. Or there are lots of ways to make things go wrong. But yeah, it's, I think one of the earliest storytelling structures that I was taught is that a short story is a sequence of try, fail, and eventually try, succeed or not, depending on how you want to end the story.
Nice. That's interesting.
Yeah. And then with each of those try, fail cycles, the stakes get higher. Maybe the initial try, fail, you've made things worse. Now, instead of trying to get out of the locked building, now you've accidentally set it on fire. Stakes are higher. Try again.
Nice. That's a really good example. I always find structuring short stories quite difficult. I like messing around with things, using different structures, but capturing that perfect moment is hard, isn't it?
It is. And it's so much more focused. In a novel, you have time to to wander a bit, to follow secondary plot lines and storylines. And with a short story, it feels like, I don't want to say constrained exactly, but it feels so much tighter.
Yeah.
I remember the advice back in the 90s that I was hearing was, you know, start with short stories, write them, publish them, build yourself up as a writer through short stories, and then you'll be able to do novels.
Yeah.
And what I found is some of the skills do carry over, but short stories are short stories and novels are novels. And just because you can do one doesn't magically mean you can do the other.
Yeah.
Totally agree with that one. Speaking of novels, you have a new one out at the very end of May. Kite Master, which you mentioned there before. Do you want to tell us a bit about what the story involves and what kind of themes and things you're exploring in this one?
I'd love to. Kite Master is one of the more difficult books that I've done to sum up in a single sentence. It started in part... Well, no, let's step back. It's a secondary world fantasy. It's standalone. And it's set in a world where the wind is pretty much central. The wind never stops. The wind drives almost everything. You know, the technology, it's all sails and windmills and windwheels and kites. A lot of the animal life has evolved to adapt to these unending winds. There are cloud serpents that live their whole lives in the air. You know, they never land. Even the stars, when they come out at night, they're not blowing up the way they do in our world. They blow across the sky in a streak, like they call it the night river.
Yeah.
And it varies from one night to the next, depending on how strong those winds are. So that's your world setting. Wow. And the character, Niel, is a kite master, meaning she has some magical ability to control the wind and to control pretty much anything that's flying on the wind, kites being the obvious one, but she has some control over birds and bats and creatures like that. And it means she is very valuable because kite masters are the ones who can pilot kite ships, these enormous sailing style ships that are flying on giant kites. And once she discovers this gift, she gets drawn into this struggle between the queen, who is also a kite master, and is, without giving spoilers, trying to use that gift for some very bad things. The queen's son is trying to prevent this and is a runaway. Niel sort of gets kidnapped and ends up on a kite ship with the runaway prince. So they're trying to survive and stop the queen and her evil kite masters from doing bad things.
Sounds fantastic. I absolutely love the world and how you've shaped everything around that unique aspect of it. And the stakes, obviously, are really, really high as well. It sounds brilliant. I'm going to pre-order a copy as soon as we finish.
Oh, thank you. It's a book that I've spent a long time working on. It started as a short story probably about 20 years ago. And I loved this idea of the kites and the control you have over them. And, you know, there are scout kites that you can strap yourself to and actually fly with your kite. And just more than a lot of my stuff, this one was driven by a sense of wonder. You know, what are those scenes? What are those moments that make me go, ooh, that's amazing. I want to do that.
Yeah. And what was it like creating the world?
It was both a lot of fun and at times very frustrating. It was fun imagining.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
All of the different aspects, all of the different implications of how this world works. Even to the point of mapping out the wind chart so I know how the kite ships could fly from point A to point B, because you're flying on kites. You have some steering here, but you're also kind of at the mercy of the winds. So sometimes you can't go in a straight line.
Yeah.
Imagining the ecosystem, imagining the stars up here. And it's very obviously not the same astronomical system as our world. So how do these stars work? What happens when one of them falls down? Are there things that live that high up? What's the religion? What's the spiritual aspect? The book starts with Niel flying the spirit kite of her husband, who had died the year before. Niel's 21. This was unexpected. She's also dealing with becoming a widow over the course of the book. But what you do in this world, in this part of the world at least, is you build the spirit kite. You fly that the 1 year after your loved one's death. And this is what flies your loved one's spirit up into the stars. And so there was so much, ooh, what about this? What about that? What if I do this? And some of it worked, some of it didn't. But I'd say overall, it was very rewarding. It was fun. And every detail you come up with makes the world feel that much more real.
Yeah. It has the effects of just drawing the reader deeper and deeper. The more they see that how much effort and thought you've put into it, then it becomes almost like a real place for people, doesn't it?
Hopefully. I mean, that kind of leads to one of the frustrating parts where you've also got to make sure none of these details you're developing are going to throw the reader out of the story.
Yeah.
Like, does this actually make sense? Would this work? Or is this a little too far? Is this something that I would read and say, yeah, right, and put the book down?
How do you usually catch them things when you edit?
Another good question. Sometimes I think you kind of feel it when you're writing it. You're realizing, oh, this is a little too cute, or I'm trying a little too hard here. Other times it helps to take some distance from the story. Like if I finish a draft, ideally I want to put it away for a little while, let my brain reset. And then come to it a little fresher.
Yeah.
It also, I'm finding it helps. I got married a few months ago, and my wife is very detail-oriented. And she has been very good at reading through some of my work and saying, nope, this doesn't work, doesn't make sense. I don't know what you were thinking here. And that's not always fun to hear, but it's very useful. and she's good at it.
Oh, congratulations on getting married.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and it's sounds brilliant that you've got an editing partner as well.
She's not like a professionally trained editor or anything, but she is really good at copy editing, proofing, catching things. It's when Kitemaster comes out, thank her for the lack of typos.
Yeah, it's definitely useful to have that extra pair of eyes. And yeah, I mean, sometimes having someone who's not professionally trained is better because you get that more authentic reader perspective, don't you?
It can help, yeah. And I think, a lot of the writing process is solitary, but it is really helpful to eventually get those other eyes on it, whether it's proofreading and catching those little typos that we don't see anymore, or sometimes it's story level things where, well, I know how the story goes in my head, and maybe I forgot to put a piece of that into the book. I know what happens.
Yeah.
But yeah, getting those extra eyes on the story, it has helped a lot. Every one of my books has been, I would say, vastly improved by editors weighing in and saying, this is great, but what about this? What about that? And, those gaps that I missed because none of us are perfect.
Yeah. It's very much a team effort, isn't it? Writing a book.
Very much. Writing it, publishing it, the whole process.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask you about was your background in psychology and how that's you think is helps with your writing. I mean, in the past we've had psychologists on the show, and I think it's really important, like, to get them insights from like psychologists, sociologists, because I think these different things all help us really get to grips with our characters, who they are, what motivates them. And I find it like psychology as a whole just really interesting anyway. So what is your background in psychology? You mentioned before that you studied it. Did you end up doing a career in it as well?
I did not. I finished my undergraduate degree in psychology, so I've got the 4-year degree. I ended up going into computer support after that. But the psychology piece, I did spend some time. I volunteered at a crisis hotline. I did some work with a sexual assault counseling program. And I think one of the biggest ways that it helped was giving me experience in just listening to people, and some of the basics of psychology, okay, understanding how the mind works, how people think and behave. That's definitely important. But then learning to listen to people with different experiences, different backgrounds, different hopes, different dreams. I feel like if you can't do that, it's going to be, I won't say impossible, but very, very difficult to write a broader range of people, or to write people who aren't thinly veiled versions of yourself. I've had people ask about, well, Jim, you're a guy. How do you write women? How do you learn to do that? Well, I talk to them, and more importantly, I listen. It's really that easy. Just listening to people talk about their lives, talk about hopes, dreams, struggles, challenges, and recognizing that they're going to be different from your own.
No, it's a brilliant bit of advice. Just listening and learning, and people tell you so much, and it's You can tell so much in body language and the things that they don't say as much as the things that they do say, and looking at the things that they focus on or put emphasis on, or the way they say certain things. I just love it. I just find it so interesting.
Oh, same, you know, and watching people act, how they act in different contexts, you know, watching someone who, how do they behave when they're up on stage or giving a presentation versus when they're on their own someplace relatively quiet. It, you know, finding the contradictions in people.
Yeah. We are bundles of contradictions, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. Humans are messy.
Yeah. That makes good material for writing.
Oh, yeah. Worries.
Do you like to use body language in your stories as like a bit of a storytelling device to like get the reader more engaged so that they're thinking about what other characters are doing or what's going on in their own heads, like just trying to piece things together? Because it's something that we often see in TV and films, isn't it? Because we're not able to go into characters' heads. So we have to ascertain things from like the way they look and respond to things like that. So as a sort of your background in psychology, do you like to inject quite a bit of that into your stories?
Interesting. I would say somewhat, yes. Partly because, you know, it's less interesting to just write Jig was happy than it is to write, you know, Jig felt the joy bubbling up in his chest and he jumped up and down for joy and squeezed his ears to keep from screaming with delight.
Yeah.
And also, I think there's a balance of, you know, what people express, what they don't express, and what they hold back. You know, sometimes, like writing a character who's angry or who's, well, let's go with the anger. You know, one way to write that and depict it would be very loud, lots of shouting, lots of gesticulating. And another way is to show that character being very quiet and working very hard to contain that anger. And sometimes that quiet anger is a lot more powerful for the story. So I think, you know, a lot depends on the character. It depends on the story. It depends on what beats you're trying to hit, what tone you're trying to set. But yeah, you have to have a range. You have to be able to do the sort of simple, express it, show it, move on. And you have to show people being more complex or more conflicted or giving mixed messages sometimes. Again, it's that whole range of being human.
Yeah, it's great. Lots of great material, like I said before. It's amazing just people watching and getting ideas from the people you see on the street. It's amazing, just from a few minutes of looking like a busy place, you just see a complete range of emotions, don't you?
I was just going to say, I've had luck with that. Just once the internet came along, I can do people watching without ever leaving the house.
Yeah.
You know, just sort of reading people's stories, reading their experiences, both what they say, what they talk about, and how they talk about it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. There's so much you can, so many resources out there. We are spoiled for choice as a writer in this day and age. One question I always like to ask everyone who comes onto the show is, what in your career has been your biggest struggle and how did you overcome it?
Ooh, biggest struggle. I told you how Goblin Quest came about and ended up with Daw and all of the happy, this sort of launched my career part of the story. There was another part of that story where when I was sending it out, I got an offer from one of the big publishers, not DAW. And it was, at that point, it was the dream. It was everything I had been working for, everything I had hoped for. I was over the moon excited. And for various reasons that we don't really have time to get into, the publisher ended up withdrawing the offer. And, you know, there were reasons, but it was devastating. I felt crushed, and I crashed hard. I went into a pretty hardcore depression for several months where, you know, up until that point, rejection, not fun, but I could handle it. I could keep writing. But this, you know, feeling like I had this dream in my hands and then it got yanked away.
Yeah.
That was hard.
Yeah, it's horrendous.
It was actually the birth of my second child was what snapped me out of it, because, oh, I have this other dream and this is good too, and I'll focus on this. And that was sort of the first step in my recovery. So, you know, thank you, Jamie, for coming along and helping to fix your dad. But no, that was definitely one of the low points. And it was a struggle to bounce back from that and keep writing, keep trying.
Yeah, it's perseverance, isn't it? It's what you need to
it
do
is.
In this game. But you got there, it's a brilliant example to everyone listening that if you love what you do, just keep trying and good things will come, hopefully. You're very active on Patreon, I've noticed, and you do share some really brilliant and honest things about writing life. And one thing you posted recently was about the earnings that you make from your writing. And it's not very often that you see authors as do this, but I mean, we do see a lot over here in like the news about like, oh, this is the average earning for writers and like how bad it is and stuff like that. And you tend to see the opposite end of the spectrum then, like all the big money that the Hollywood names earn. And it's really rare to see writers just being honest and open and direct about what they make. So I really hats off to you for opening up about that and sharing that information. So can you tell us why you thought that was an important step to take and more about writers' earnings as a whole?
It's because so few people do talk about it. And so there's that sense, kind of like you were saying, it's one extreme or the other. Either if you're going to be a writer, it means you'll be poor, you'll never make a penny in your life, you'll just be destitute and, you know, working at McDonald's or basically life will be bad. Or you're a writer, so you must be Stephen King level of successful with your own castle and yacht and spend your days sipping champagne in a limousine with your agent in New York. And so I think the more we have the conversation, the more we get, you know, at least a more realistic picture of the range of writing careers and how that can work. I feel like I've been very fortunate, and I'm definitely not at Stephen King levels, but I feel like I've been fairly successful. But also I want to put out there, this is what that looks like. This is how it varies from year to year, because writing can be very, unstable.
Yeah.
You know, 1 year you have a 3-book deal and you get a big advance, but then the next year you have to write the books and there's no more advance money coming in. So that graph can vary a lot. I guess I just feel like we're all better off if we have more information and more knowledge.
Yeah, because I suppose it's like going, like asking for a pay rise at work, isn't it? Like if you know what the person who sits next to you, who does the same job as you, earns, and it turns out that they earn more, then
exactly,
yeah, then you can quite rightly ask for the same amount of money, and it puts more power in authors' hands, doesn't it? Really,
I had a conversation almost exactly like that early on at a convention, talking to another author from my publisher. And I think I had sold 2 or 3, maybe even 4 books to them by that point. And they were like the $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 advances. And I was saying, I don't know. Is that good? Is that, and the other author kind of paused and said, well, you know, it all depends. Everything depends. But he also wrote for the same publisher, for the same editor, and he told me they will go to 5-figure advances for, you know, even, I don't remember exactly how he said it, but he made it clear that, okay, that's nice. They can go higher.
Yeah.
And that was huge, because it wouldn't, at that point, I was just so grateful to be writing and publishing that the idea that I could go in and say, hey, I want more money, or hey, I think maybe I deserve a raise, or even just having the conversation,
yeah,
was terrifying.
Yeah, I get that. Because like you say, you've had the dream in your hands before and it's been snatched away and you don't want it to happen again, do you?
Right. It's like, I just want to be grateful for what I have, because I don't want to lose it. I think that's one of the areas where it's also been really helpful to have an agent, so that I can talk to him and say, hey, I heard that this publisher gives out more advances. Can we ask for more money next time? And he comes back and says, well, let me look at your sales numbers, and I think maybe we can do this. And I am happy to say that the advances have gone up over time.
Yeah, so it's great that you're so honest about it. And I mean, do you speak to a lot of authors? Do you know what like other people earn as like a sort of general average?
I do not. Maybe 10 years back, I did a survey of several hundred authors, just looking at the advances for first novels, trying to get more of a sense of that.
Yeah,
I would have to look at the numbers, but I think it came in around $5,000 or so.
Yeah.
But just average author from year to year, I don't know.
Yeah, like I say, there's so many variables as well.
Right. And an author who makes $1,000 one year might have something take off the next year and be, I mean, maybe even 6 figures. I don't know. It's probably rare, but you know, writing it can be a little unpredictable sometimes.
Yeah. And you're obviously doing more of a hybrid thing now, aren't you? Because you're relaunching Goblin Quest yourself. And do you think that sort of approach works? I mean, there's a bit more work involved for you, but financially, do you think it would be more rewarding?
Oh, it's definitely more work. More rewarding. I prefer to put out original novels through a commercial publisher, yeah, if I can. They have much better distribution. They're able to get the books out to a lot more people than I can do directly.
Yeah.
But then over time, those books fall into the backlist. They're not selling that many copies anymore. It starts to make sense to say, okay, I will take these back. I will start selling them directly myself, which lets me boost sales a bit, reduce the price, while you're also able to get a much bigger chunk of the royalties with each sale. So I think it does make sense to do both, at least for me.
Yeah. It's like the cycle a book goes through, isn't it? Like, goes through the traditional routes, and then over time, with the rights revert back, then
you can right.
sort of relaunch it, can't you? And put extra things in, and new covers, new content, and yeah, you basically get two runs of the book.
Pretty much, yeah. And even if I can't get that extra sales boost, if we get to a point where, and I'm just making up numbers here, say a book is selling 10 copies a month, you know, through the traditional publisher, maybe it's an 8% royalty rate, 10 a month, I make $8. If I'm putting it out myself as a $5 ebook, I might make $35 for the same 10 sales.
Yeah.
And I do that by selling the book more cheaply through putting it out myself. Nice. So yeah, it just, the math kind of makes sense at that point.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's off to you, Jim, for being honest and open. And I think if anyone's looking for more advice like that, then do check out Jim's Patreon page, packed with lots of great stories as well, and lots of good insights.
Thank you.
But yeah, one last question for you, Jim, just to wrap things up. The question I always like to finish on is, what advice or what single piece of advice would you have for any aspiring fantasy writer out there listening?
I would go back to what I was talking about with Goblin Quest and say, write what you love, write what makes you happy. Don't worry as much about what you should be writing. Don't worry as much about what's popular or what's hot right now. Write what makes you happy and build from there.
Brilliant advice. Nice and simple. And it's something that I completely agree. I've recently finished the project, and it was something that I was really passionate about and really like keen to do and like excited to share with people. And it was just a completely different experience compared to like previous projects I've done, where I haven't really always been like fully into it as much. But I completely agree. And yeah, I think even if you just do a short story about something you love and test it out, it's well worth doing.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah. But Jim, thank you so much for giving up your time. I know how busy you are at the moment with the two books out this month, and I really appreciate you sharing your insights and your honest thoughts and your brilliant experiences as well. It's fantastic to chat with someone so gifted as yourself. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Richie. This has been a lot of fun. It's been good talking to you.
Thank you very much. If anyone wants to learn more about you and your writing and your books, where's the best place to go?
Easiest place would be jimchines.com. Then there are links at the top to all of the different social media sites, but jimchines.com is sort of the central hub.
Nice. I'll put links to that in the description, as well as links to the books as well, and Jim's Patreon page as well. Jim, thank you very much again. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Likewise.
And everyone, thank you at home for listening, and we'll speak to you soon. Thank you for listening to the Fantasy Writers Toolshed. If you'd like to join our writing community on Discord and get access to fantasy writing classes and books on Patreon, check the links in the description. And if you don't want to miss any future episodes, be sure to follow or subscribe, And to support the show, leave a quick rating on Spotify or iTunes and share this episode on social media or with anyone who you think may be interested. Thank you very much for listening.